absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig interkulturell.
Absolut interkulturalisch.
Absolutamente interkulturell.
Absolutely intercultural.
Welcome to show 190 of Absolutely Intercultural, the show about all things intercultural. My name's Anne Fox, and this show is coming to you from Denmark. Well, how do we do it, you may be asking yourselves, as the last show came from Brazil. And yet, we run on a shoestring, which means almost no money at all. The answer is, of course, that wherever we go, we take our recorders with us, on the off chance that we will meet interesting new people with different perspectives, which we do all the time, of course. So in this show, I will be taking you to Bangladesh, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nepal, Zimbabwe, and Cameroon. For example, why do people learn English in Pakistan?
If somebody knows English, his ability to earn increases by about 17%.
Wow.
And if somebody can learn English and can speak it well, his ability to earn improves by 35%. So yeah, we are doing our bit to help those youngsters improve their earning potential.
And what do you think the best way of delivering training would be to the semi-literate migrant workers of Bangladesh?
Using mobile phones, because all the migrant workers, mm-hmm. again, yeah. have their own mobile phones with an SD slot and developing some materials for use. That, I mean, it's not been done.
These were snippets of recordings made at the IATEFL conference in Manchester last month. IATEFL stands for International Association of Teachers of English as a Foreign Language. And it's the word international which attracts people from all over the world. The conference is quite large, but of course not everyone can afford the time and money to attend. So it's really great that there is now a very professional service during each annual conference, streaming sessions and interviews online. In this show, I'll be bringing you snippets of interviews from the IATEFL website. If you're curious to see more, then go to iatefl.britishcouncil.org/2015. And there you can watch all the recordings that were made, for free, right up until the next conference in April 2016. You will also find the link to the videos on our blog at www.absolutely-intercultural.com, where you can also leave us a comment. IATEFL is for teachers of English, but intercultural matters often emerge because you have foreign teachers working far away from home. You have the question of whether it's right for the English language to dominate globally as it does right now. And you also have questions about how far teacher training dreamed up in the West can be translated to other contexts, to name just a few of the issues which regularly come up at the IATEFL conference. So let's start in Nepal. This is Uma Shrestha talking about how Nepalese teachers expect their teacher trainers to look like. Now, while Umesh is Nepalese, he works for the British Council, and he often meets resistance, though maybe not for the reason you think. Let's call this absolutely fresh-faced.
The image of a teacher trainer is like you have to have grey hairs, maybe a little bit of more wrinkles in your face. So relatively, I'm kind of young, like these guys. So when I go to teacher training, and I go for government school teachers, they've been teaching for 30 years, 40 years in government schools. And when they see me, like, they have this different expectation of a trainer. So what they do is, first, for a couple of hours, they just resist me, like this. And as a trainer, to see the trainees' faces stone cold, not responsive at all, it's a big nightmare. So I start, usually my warm-up activities are about myself, about I joke about myself, I humiliate myself, and then that gets them going, seeing that I have had my own share of difficulties while learning and while teaching English. And then when I build this a common ground, a shared experience, and then they start cooperating and they start acting like real trainees. So big resistance and this issue of hierarchy.
Yeah,
that's what I face.
Yeah, that's something which I think goes beyond Nepal as well, doesn't it? Yeah, hierarchy, seniority can be problematic for a trainer. But a nice way of humanizing the situation.
Yeah.
It's your solution.
So age is important in Nepal. By the way, let me just reassure you that we had word that Umesh and his two Nepalese colleagues who attended ITEFL are okay after the recent earthquake in Nepal. There was a great deal about using mobile devices to learn English at ITEFL, and perhaps unexpectedly, this is also relevant to countries such as Pakistan, where dumb, as against smartphone ownership, is much higher than internet accessibility. We heard at the start of the show Bilal Ahmad talking about the direct financial effect of learning English. So let's now hear how Pakistanis are using their radio and their mobile phones to learn English as we go absolutely mobile.
Radio Pakistan is a partner that has reached across 3.5 million listeners in Pakistan. It has the best rural coverage as well. So every Saturday, teachers would tune in to teaching English radio and learners would tune in to learn English radio. And they would listen to whatever was like, and they would listen to teaching English radio, incorporate that in their teaching practice, and then come back again on the next Saturday to learn more about how to teach English effectively.
Yeah, I mean, mobile is something that in Pakistan, the internet connectivity is about 10% all over, whereas the mobile connectivity is about 73%. Mm-hmm. So this is through mobile that we can reach out to real masses.
Mobile learning, radio learning, this is something that is very, very useful in a country like Pakistan, where people have access to mobiles, and also maybe, but people may not have access to education, mm-hmm. to quality education, to quality English instruction in itself. But they want to learn and better themselves. So this is something we think teaching English radio, learning English radio, as well as mobile learning, is something that we can use for developing English language effectively in Pakistan, and also for helping out and for helping out people, the quest of knowledge and learning in very, very remote areas of Pakistan.
We also heard about mobile learning for not just English, but also intercultural communication from Mike Solly of Britain's Open University. Mike Solly is hoping to build a collection of video content to view on your mobile phone for the migrant workers of Bangladesh. In this case, video content helps train a target group that is often semi-literate.
There are whole villages where in almost every house someone will be working in the Middle East. So mm-hmm. we chose a particular village and worked through them.
Yeah. And what kind of things, in terms of English, what kind of things do those workers need? Is it for the kind of day-to-day work, or is it to sort out kind of administrative things, or how does that improve their lives?
Yeah, obviously it varies, and it varies partly according to destination. So what we're finding is that English has been flagged as either the most important thing or often the second most important thing that migrant workers would need in order to make both their professional and personal lives mm-hmm. Easier. Mm-hmm. And in terms of professional lives, and going back to economic improvement, there is some evidence that having more English will help them in being promoted. Uh-huh. Not only English.
Yeah.
English is one of the languages, but of course, Arabic as well. But interestingly, English is still, in certain contexts, quite often the lingua franca. So many feel that they need both English and Arabic.
Yeah. And again, you'll be using kind of video on SD cards for mobile phones. That's sort of part of the...
Well, at the moment, the research that we've been looking at is just looking at the needs of migrant workers. Mm. But what we realise is that, in fact, English is only a part of the mix, and mm-hmm. actually the needs go a lot further than that. Many of the migrant workers have no cultural orientation whatsoever, or very little at best, and many of them haven't really left their villages, their immediate uh-huh. area. They've never been on a plane
yeah,
before.
It must be huge.
So
huge,
massive
huge.
Needs, quite aside from language. So what we were thinking, many of the migrant workers are also semi-literate in their own languages. Mm-hmm. So to provide resources, it seems that one way of doing it would be using mobile phones, because all the migrant workers, mm-hmm. again, yeah. have their own mobile phones with an SD slot uh-huh. and developing some materials for use. That, I mean, it's yeah, not yeah. been done yet,
yeah.
but this is what we're hoping uh-huh. to find interest uh-huh. in developing these materials. And yeah. we've got a kind of prototype.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that's great. Sounds really interesting and a really good project to be involved with.
We'll be hearing more about Mike Solly's project in a future show. Now let's go absolutely military and find out why army officers in Afghanistan spend 15% of their officer training on learning English. Tarek Welizada explains.
And why do they need the English though?
The way they thought about that was that how can we maintain the existing kind of relationship and the trust that has been built between the Afghan National Security Forces and UK Armed Forces. Mm-hmm. And that's only possible through the kind of communication that they have to do, mm-hmm. exchange of ideas and cultural understanding. Mm-hmm. So unless the cadets who graduate from the academy, unless they have got the basic level of English skills, they will not be able to communicate with their UK uh-huh. mentors, UK yeah. partners. And if they are not able to do that, how can we yeah. Build that trust? Yeah. So learning English is the key thing in terms of maintaining the existing trust and relationship yeah. and building it further on.
Do you also have to work with the kind of British officers and make sure that they understand the cultural side of things too?
Exactly. That's one thing. And it's to be honest, that's quite difficult because mm-hmm. There is so much turnover of personnel within mm-hmm. the British Armed Force in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
They've got certain posting durations. Every time there is that turnover, I basically have to start from square one,
yeah, yeah.
kind of mentoring them, telling them the things that mm-hmm. Might be sensitive for Afghans, and telling Afghans obviously the things that the Brits would think of to be sensitive. So I'm closely involved with the British military officers, mm-hmm. even the top general who is in charge of running the mentoring program of the academy. And it's good mm-hmm. That we have been able to kind of develop that relationship and mm-hmm. maintain the kind of trust that's needed between these two countries.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Must be fantastic work.
Yeah, it is.
For our next two slots, we'll be moving to Africa to hear from two of the most inspirational speakers of the IATEFL conference. If you have the time to watch these two plenaries on the IATEFL website, I really think you'll find it worthwhile. Common to both was an absolutely bottom-up approach to change. The first plenary speaker was Anne Cotton, who discovered that there was not a systematic bias against girls in Zimbabwe.
The issue that I work on is girls' education in Africa. That's uh-huh. been my professional life for the last 22 years. Uh-huh. I'm very much an educationist at heart. But I started this work after I'd done a study uh-huh. in a very poor district in Zimbabwe called Nyaminyami, where there was a high disparity between the enrollment of boys and girls in the school system, and I was looking at the reasons behind that.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of reasons came out of that?
Well, when I went, what I expected to find was a resistance by families to the education of girls. That is what I had read. This was the early 90s, and that's what the literature was telling me. And when I went to Mola, what I was told by the community, by parents, by teachers, by the children themselves, and by the local traditional leader, was that what was behind girls' exclusion from education was poverty. It was the culture of poverty that was holding girls back. Because families, when they're poor, have to make a choice as to how they spend their money. They couldn't afford the education of every child, so they favoured sons because they had a much better chance of paid work in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
The context of Zimbabwe was particularly interesting because in Rhodesia, prior to independence, there were only 60 places for every 1,000 black children in what was a segregated system. Every white child went to school, well-resourced schools, well-trained teachers. So it was part, of course, of the whole colonial experience. Mm-hmm. Education was a way of holding people back. People, went into low-paid work. And so that, for me, was a profoundly, the history, the injustice was what I saw. But mm-hmm. even so, 10 years after independence, although Zimbabwe had massively expanded access to education to 600 places for every 1,000 children, in a desegregated system, still the majority outside school were rural girls. And I was looking at the reasons behind that.
If you move on to the plenary recording, you'll find out that Cotton set up an organisation called CAMFED, which not only gives girls an education, but helps them in many other ways they need in order to set up an independent and useful life for themselves. This is a wonderful example of a bottom-up initiative where Cotton helps by listening to those in need. The next extract features Harry Kucha-Kucha from Cameroon, who learned how to teach classes of 250 students by enlisting their help. I must admit that this was not what I was expecting to hear, with my head filled with stereotypes of authoritarian African teachers.
My personal experience of teaching 235 teenagers in a classroom that was meant for 60, many of my students standing outside in temperatures of 46 degrees, with no textbooks, very few textbooks in the classroom, is that I needed, at one point I found that I needed to rely on my students as partners. And what happened was that gradually we moved towards a pedagogy of autonomy, in the sense that my learners were part of the material development. They created their own materials, they went out there and looked for materials in English, and through a process of mutual negotiation, we were able to identify those articles or whatever information they found in English that may be relevant in helping us meet the curriculum goals, because of course that's the aim of language education within that kind of context. We need to meet the curriculum goals, and so my students are engaged in negotiating the goals with them and giving them the opportunity to be part of the material development process and to be part of the decision making as to what and how our language lessons will develop. So I think one thing is recognizing that students come to the classroom with lots of potential and tapping into those potentials, but also building their sense of their self-perception and their sense of autonomy so that they think more critically about the learning process. That way it eases the job of the teacher. And I did benefit from that a lot, and that's kind of shaped the way I look at practice in the mm-hmm. classroom and the way I look at my students at whatever age they would be. I do think that students are the best people to tell us about learning.
In the next show I produce at the beginning of July, we'll be hearing from Atiyeh Al-Habal, who links up his students in a very rural school in Palestine with classes all over the world. And in fact, he's looking for more partner schools. So if you're interested to find out more about what goes on in Palestine, then mail him at honouredboy@hotmail.com. We'll also be putting that address on our blog. We'll also be hearing from Kusi Nda in Côte d'Ivoire, who dares to do things differently in his classroom. It's a bit like Harry Kucha-Kucha in Cameroon. And finally, we'll be hearing much more from Mike Solly about his video lessons for Bangladeshi migrants. That will be in July, and in the meantime, the next show will be coming to you from Germany on June the 5th with Laurent Borgmann, who I think has now returned from Brazil. Follow us on our Facebook page or leave us a comment on the blog at www.absolutely-intercultural.com, where you can find all the links you need to catch up on the content of the IATEFL conference, and also that email to get in contact with the teacher in Palestine. Thanks to IATEFL for allowing me to use the recordings, and until then, stay tuned.
Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tvärkulturell.
Absolut interkulturell.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.